This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. At the outset, I have to apologize for that Hugh Hewitt editorial you just heard before we opened the show today. Did you hear that? Talking about spring training and baseball. And Hugh is a Cleveland fan, but I mean, he used a word that is verboten, that's anachronistic. The Cleveland Indians. I'm sorry, but I'm just repeating what Hugh said. So obviously, he has not gotten the memo on the new Major League Baseball nomenclature, particularly as it pertains to his beloved Cleveland baseball team. Wow. Yeah, sorry about that. But speaking of baseball, Mayor Triple Threat said the other day that she believes the Cubs and White Sox will be able to have fans in the stands at some point this summer, so long as their plans for having fans pass safetyist muster, right? So we want to take some thoughts on that in terms of what the Cubs and Sox should do in order to pass muster with the safetyist ruling class in Chicago and to have fans in the stands, to the extent that you even have any interest in Major League Baseball anymore, or that has been beaten out of you, like perhaps your interest in the NFL and some of the other major sports that have become hyper-politicized, the NBA at the top of the list, but it's also a terrible product. Still a good product on the field in baseball and football. Basketball, not so much. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I've got an idea. Just borrow the Chi-Com model. Yeah, the anal swabs, of course, is what I'm talking about. China now making it mandatory for foreign visitors to their fair land to be anally swabbed. That is a procedure which involves a 5-centimeter-long saline-soaked swab shoved up your backside. And apparently it is more accurate than other on-the-spot virus tests, according to the Chi-Coms. So here's why that makes sense, because, of course, that is the same philosophy. You know, we share a philosophy, Chicago's political ruling class and the Chinese communists, number one. And number two, you have the added benefit that Chicagoans are socialized to take it up the bum. You know, as a matter of course, on a daily basis, particularly from their duly elected and thus selected political betters. What do you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. John in Portage Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. You're just the best, Dan, and you make my day in the morning. But I just wanted to say, what about the social distancing at the urinals at the Wrigley Field? It would just be terrible. I mean,
do they still have troughs there? It's been a minute since I've
yes. And it would just be a really, really amazing thing to see the safetyist, social distancing. I'm kind of nervous, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. I do. Thanks for the call, John. And, you know, the troughs always made me uncomfortable. This is pre-COVID, because you get a lot of side eyes in the men's room at Wrigley Field, if you know what I mean. Mike in Union, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Hey, will our new president be required when he visits his buddies over there in China to get this test, or will he be exempt from it? And, just want to see what your reaction is.
It's a great question. As with mask wearing, you want your political betters to lead by example, don't you? Now, I know many of our political betters would opt for that if it was optional. But they should absolutely lead by example so that we may follow their example. And I don't see why anal swabbing would be any exception to that, do you? Oh, by the way, just in terms of competition among the lockdowners to be more draconian, it seems like Lightfoot may have inched ahead of Gavin Newsom. And out there in California now, they're closing in on 2 million signatures to put that recall Gavin Newsom question on the ballot. They need 1.5 million, but of course you want to get many more than that so you can avoid any petition challenge. So it's tracking like there's going to be a recall election in California, which will be fun. But Gavin Newsom, perhaps sensing his political peril, said yesterday that California fans can likely catch Major League Baseball games in person when the season begins in April. A little bit more aggressive. I have all the confidence in the world fans will be back safely. So not giving sort of the at some point in the indeterminate future statement that Triple Threat has given, saying, you know, opening day, expect fans in the stands in California. Gavin Newsom, oh boy, all of a sudden somebody gets a little bit more responsive when he's facing a recall election. If only we had such initiative here in Chicagoland to try to hold our betters accountable. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Well, Cuomo's got a job. If he ever gets kicked out of office, he can go to China. Plenty of work there now for him.
Yeah.
And they should have kneeling cardboard cutouts for all the sports, too.
Kneeling, say that again? What should they have?
Kneeling cardboard cutouts.
Oh, kneeling
carpet.
Exactly. Thanks for the call. Yeah, that's true. You don't want to lose that protest feel that you're used to at professional sporting events, sure. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking a call. When they had all this right in the heart of the pandemic, right in the heat of it, all this rioting and all this kind of stuff and all the people all piled up on each other. Then you had the politicians, including Lightweight, with the megaphone and out there with the crowds and everything like that. That is in the heat of it and everything. Now, when everything's all over, they're trying to still push it and everything, and even have, like, with the sports games and everything, and just keep stretching this thing to take and keep the power over the people and everything like that, and keep everybody locked up. And it's all a bunch of BS.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Jim in Sheboygan.
Yeah, so last year in March, when in Milwaukee, my wife's company, which is a large company, basically the general counsel sent a letter to the city of Milwaukee.
Don't pay attention to that. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the general counsel from her company basically sent a letter to the city of Milwaukee and said, we're not gonna abide by any lockdowns or anything. And they were left alone. And they operated all last year. I think the White Sox and the Cubs, I think they ought to just push back. I think they ought to send a letter to the city and say, we're opening up. We're going to do it safely, and the crowds will come.
Yeah.
The crowds will come.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Jim. I mean, but of course, Jerry Reinsdorf, I didn't see the Ricketts family on the letter, but Jerry Reinsdorf is a signatory to the Mayor Lightfoot, we're with you for your equitable and on board for your equitable reopening plan. So, you know, then Jerry would have to walk that back in and stop being such a rent-seeking whore like all those other CEOs that signed that ridiculous letter laying supine before the political ruling class in this city. How pathetic are they? Pathetic. So, yeah, I agree with you. If I was the owner of a baseball team or any other sports team, we're going to do this. Come arrest us all. Arrest all the fans, arrest the entire front office, come arrest us. Molon Labe, Triple Threat. But of course that takes guts and actual civic leadership, which is absent in Chicago, as we all know. Tom in Deer Park.
Dan, good morning. This swabbing, it sounds like an invasive procedure. I don't know about you, I'm not going to submit to some Andy Frayne. If Reinsdorf or the Ricketts get a medical professional, be it a Dr. Fauci, a Dr. Biden,
sure,
a Dr. Zeus, or a Dr. Broca, I'll submit. Otherwise, no way.
All right. Thanks for the call, Tom. Yeah. You know, maybe if Andy the Clown were still around in the old Comiskey, from the old Comiskey, maybe. But I agree with you. Yeah, I'm not going to submit to that either. But also, I've already given up all my season tickets to Chicago sports teams. They've beat support for the teams, even my beloved White Sox, out of me. I mean, I'll still support them, but from afar, not from inside. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Get your tickets for Biden, the first 100 days on March 20th. Tickets are on sale now at 560theanswer.com/Biden.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Governor Nipplestudes took to the dais yesterday to offer a heartfelt apology, and I'm using that word in quotation marks. This is the second time he's tried to apologize. It's not an easy thing for, you know, an egomaniacal D-bag like Party Nips to do. So the first effort was, it's just his zany sense of humor. He's just a madcap guy at the office trying to make everybody comfortable because, you know, the people he works with as well as his subordinates are like family to him. Well, that didn't work. That just exacerbated the calls for his resignation or impeachment. So he tried again. 18 minutes worth of pablum, but I won't inflict that upon you. Here's his best foot forward, his opening sentence or two.
First, I fully support a woman's right to come forward. And I think it should be encouraged in every way. I now understand that I acted in a way that made people feel uncomfortable. It was unintentional, and I truly and deeply apologize for it.
Oh.
I feel awful about it, and frankly, I am embarrassed by it. And that's not easy to say, but that's the truth. But this is what I want you to know, and I want you to know this from me directly. I never touched anyone inappropriately.
Mm-hmm. And he repeated that for emphasis. A quick aside, I finally figured out who he sounds like. He sounds like Christopher Walken. Well, not exactly Christopher Walken with that deliberate delivery, turning one-syllable words into two-syllable words, but more like the Jay Moore impersonation of Christopher Walken. Listen.
It's good to be here. At my age, it's good to be anywhere. That was a joke.
First,
it's good to be here. At my age, it's good to be anywhere. That was a joke.
Woman's right to come.
It says close, isn't it? Yeah, I knew he sounded like somebody, and of course it was a caricature of somebody because he's a caricature of a human being. I'm talking about Party Nips there, not Jay Moore or Christopher Walken, both of whom I enjoy. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. How's that topology sit with you? First of all, the last pronouncement you heard from him in that clip, I never touched anyone inappropriately. There's a picture of it. There's a picture of it that was on the front page of the New York Post just 2 days ago. There's a picture of him, the third woman who came forward at this wedding where she met him. She didn't know him. And you see him with both of his hands on her cheeks. who does that? And, of course, she said that not only did he put his hand on the small of her back when they were posing for a picture, which she swatted away, but that he attempted to kiss her after he put both hands on her cheek. And you see both hands on her cheeks. So I don't know. I'm inclined to believe her version of the events at that wedding, aren't you? Non-apology. By the way, here's a little fun twist of irony here. Because remember, his protestations when there was allegations of sexual harassment inside state government, much as we've seen here in state government in Illinois, to no great effect. And he strongly rebuked a female reporter asking him about what he was going to do to address any sort of systemic sexual harassment inside state government, saying the following.
Well, look, you have it going on in journalism.
Yeah, I know.
What are you going to do differently?
But the question is about state government.
Yeah, it's about state government. I could tell you later in great detail about that if you're interested.
You and journalism. And it's about you and journalism. And it's about state government. And it's about carpentry.
Is your administration going to do anything differently to maybe be a little bit more
aware? We will have policies in state government, obviously, that affect state government. But I think you missed the point.
Yeah, and then he goes on to explain the point to her again. A little mansplaining. Uh-oh. It's running afoul of leftist protocols, isn't it? By the way, just on the topic of journalism, the left-wing Poynter Institute has weighed in saying, you know what, it was inappropriate for Chris Cuomo to have Andrew Cuomo, Fredo, to have Party Nips on his show, and now CNN's taking a credibility hit as a result of him previously having him on the show, but not having him on now because obviously he's conflicted, but he wasn't conflicted before. Oh, thanks so much, Poynter Institute. Way to hold up the canons of journalism. You're rallying after the fact when everybody else is throwing, from the left, is throwing nipple studs under the bus. Poynter Institute now finds it safe to say the obvious thing. Such a joke, which is why so-called journalism has become a punchline. Oh, but I know we'll get to your calls and some MOS from outside Grand Central Station, two New Yorkers weighing in on this. But this is a fun story from The Post, which has really been the paper of record on this story. By the way, can we get a non-apology about the nursing home deaths and the cover-up of said deaths, too, while we're at it, while we're focused on him? Not just make this all about his boorish behavior towards women. Two examples from the actual sexual harassment training that all employees of New York State are required to instruct, that are required to undergo. Two case studies from an October 29th edition of the state's online sexual harassment prevention model training. One, called The Boss with a Bad Attitude, involves a male supervisor named Paul who tells a female subordinate named Sharon that he is glad she joined the staff because she is easy on the eyes. So would that be like asking a 25-year-old if she about her sex life and if she would date older men? Another and by the way, that's the same thing Lindsay Boylan, the initial woman who came forward, who's in her mid-30s, said, too, about his overtures of that were a lot more aggressive than you're easy on the eyes. Another case study is entitled Too Close for Comfort, and involves a female boss named Sarah who touches the hand or shoulder of a subordinate named Keisha while discussing Keisha's reports with her. Eventually, Sarah traps Keisha in her office, then runs her hand over Keisha's breast when Keisha leaves after a meeting. By the way, these sexual harassment training manuals are absurd, okay? I got that, as so much of this mandatory identitarian Me Too training and Me Too training is. But nonetheless, these are what Cuomo did is right out of the handbook of what not to do from the manual that all New York State employees are forced to suffer through as part of, as a condition of their employment. I mean, it's just, this guy is just really something. And I'm not the only one who thinks so. Our friends over at Newsmax did man on the street interviews of New Yorkers in and around Grand Central Station, asking whether or not they think that Party Nips should resign.
Andrew Cuomo, should he resign?
Absolutely.
Why do you say that?
Sooner the better. He's the worst governor in the history of the state. Usually where there's smoke, there's fire, I find.
Who do you trust more, Andrew Cuomo or Chris Cuomo?
Neither.
Should he resign? What do you think?
I like Cuomo.
Why do you like him?
Because he's Italian. I'm Italian.
Rudy Giuliani was too.
I don't like him. Sorry.
Boo. Bye, Cuomo. Bye, Andy.
They have to wait for the investigation.
There should be an investigation first.
Nah, he shouldn't resign. I don't think so.
Should he retire? Should go to jail?
Sorry, dude. You f***ed up.
Governor Andrew Cuomo, should he resign?
Yes.
Should he resign? Should he be impeached? What are your thoughts?
I think he should. I think there needs to be an investigation, to be fair about it.
It's not looking good for him. He's going to need women to come out in his defense. I mean, Melissa DeRosa,
you know, she should be speaking out for him. I mean, that's the only way he's going to be saved.
What is your biggest concern? Is it the sexual harassment allegations or what he did with the nursing homes?
There's a long list.
Cuomo had no problem getting his brother on there with the prop and the fake Q-tip and laughing it up. It would be like, you know, Giuliani being on CNN laughing it up while bodies burned on in the buildings on September 11th. Guy's writing a book about leadership. Guy has audacity.
He does have that audacity. That's a generous way of putting it. He also said yesterday as part of his phony baloney mea culpa that he will not resign. And it's going to be difficult to remove him, although not impossible. And he may just have so few friends and he may just be so tone deaf when it comes to damage control on this that he does generate the 2/3 of the state assembly required to bounce him. He may just be that bad and that friendless. And that's sort of a local knowledge story. I spoke with Michael Goodwin from the New York Post about this a bit yesterday. And you've seen other political consultants who've been in and around New York politics on the Dem side say just how friendless Andrew Cuomo is, going back to when he was the enforcer, political enforcer for his father, all the way to present. And by the conduct and the arrogance, you can understand why he would be a little bit short on friends in this time of crisis. Clay and Wheeling, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. 2 points, kind of quick. The first one is, I think my favorite line is, this is hard. This is hard for me to stand up, or loosely quoting. I mean, between that and the crocodile tears, he wasn't up there giving an apology. He was up there because he got caught with his hands in the cookie jar, and he's got ink all over his face, and now he wants the sympathy back on him. That's what it is at the end of the day. Second point, real quick, I understand that this is very important. Totally understand that, you know, these three women have, you know, full rights to press all this. But I really hope the media stays on the nursing home.
Absolutely.
I really want them to focus on that. That's thousands of lives lost, excuse me, because of him.
Absolutely. So, thanks for the call, Clay. And, you know, it's a good point that you make about the trying to muster the crocodile tears and so forth. You know, you'd expect a better performance from an International Emmy Award winner, wouldn't you? Roger on the South Side.
Hey, morning. I think you might be right on the Cuomo thing. I think, as you said like 2 days ago, he might not be useful to the rest of them anymore. They're already, as they say, gathering the knives for him. And the other thing is, too, let's be honest here. And this is coming from, you know, an old school half chauvinist who's not a chauvinist. If you know about three of them, how many do you not know about? And how many different girls over the time his dad was in there and he was working in state government and with their money, how many think he was sleeping with?
Well,
you know,
well,
I know that's all just pointing the finger, but
no. Well, Roger, I mean, thanks for the call. Your point is well taken, because what did he say? What's his defense? You know, what I was doing was wrong, boy, I was just ignorant. I had no idea I was making people feel uncomfortable. I had no idea I was creating awkward situations. Boy, I'll tell you, you know, I'm throwing myself on the mercy of the court here. I just was clueless about it. Well, if you were clueless about it, you think it's just those three. I mean, not that I believe that, but if that's the posture he's going to take, you think it was just those three women he was, quote unquote, clueless in terms of his interaction? No. Of course not. This is how he operates. And you see it in all of these clips. Here's another one from a Women for Cuomo event in Brooklyn. Listen to this. Listen to how he addresses the crowd, and it sort of goes past them, but nonetheless weird.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, what a pleasure to be here. One of the few men in a room full of women. Could be worse. Could be worse. Usually is worse.
Tom on the Northwest Side. Hey, Tom.
Hey, good morning, guys. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I think Nipple Rings Gambino is one of your best, Dan.
Thank you very much.
The thing about the left is these people, they are classic. You know, defer. Now all these ladies are coming out, and I have no doubt that they, you know, had a very disappointing encounter with nipple rings. But what about the poor and the sad case of all of these elderly people basically being killed?
Yeah, no, I agree. Thanks for the call, Tom. Same point that Clay from Wheeling made. And I completely agree. He should be peppered when he subjects himself to queries from the press about the nursing home scandal, which, by the way, is under investigation. So that's not going to go away. And while that is pending, the questions about it shouldn't go away. He shouldn't be able to go anywhere in public without somebody asking him about that. Absolutely. That is, I mean, based on what we know so far, just based on the allegations from the three women, the obviously the deaths and the lying about the policy that was the proximate cause of said deaths is the much bigger issue. But this is the more salacious issue, and it's the easier issue for the leftists to cover and to throw him under the bus over, so this is what's getting the emphasis. But you're right. Pete and Racine.
Good morning. You know, he can be as sincere as can be, or they can be crocodile tears. It still boils down to the fact he did what he did, and he needs to pay the consequences. Those of us that are old enough to remember the Beretta show, he said, don't do the crime if you can't do the time, and that's what it comes down to.
Thanks, Pete. Chip in St. Charles.
What Joe Biden said to Tara Reid, come on, man, I thought you liked me. And I think Cuomo wants to run for president. Diddling small, younger women is a prerequisite resume enhancement for Democrats. So he's seeking higher office.
Not anymore. Thanks for the call, Chip. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Why is it that K through 12 education hasn't lived up to the promise of Brown v. Board of Education? Ending separate but equal. Why hasn't that happened in places like Chicago and New York and L.A. and Baltimore? Because of white privilege? Because of white male oppressors? Or because of a ideology that has lorded over those urban centers for 50 to 100 years, practiced by white champagne socialists and race-hustling leftist Democrat socialists just the same? This story from the Fox affiliate in Baltimore. And let me tell you, if you scratch the surface in places that perpetrate all sorts of frauds, like Chicago, perpetrating frauds on how many students are actually enrolled pre-pandemic at some of these schools that are built for 2 and 3,000 kids and have 2 and 300 kids in them now, as we've discussed on this show, and we name the schools.
Oh, yeah.
We reported on it.
Chicago Vocational, you said 4,000. They have 732 now.
If they're perpetrating one fraud for the purposes of the convenience and benefit of the adults in the system, you don't think they're perpetrating others? This story out of Baltimore is remarkable all the way around, from the single mom in the story to the entire power structure of the Baltimore City school system. And you want to focus all the attention and resources, it's a resource issue all the time. You want to capitulate, as the Democrat socialists do, before the apparatchiks in the teachers' unions in big urban centers. Get your kids out of the government school system, because what you see in the suburbs is gradations of what you're seeing in the cities. Tiffany France is the woman's name, and she has a young man who is her son who she thought was going to graduate from high school this year. Nope.
He's stressed, and I am too. Like, I told him I probably would start crying. Like, my son is, I don't know what to do for him.
This coming June is when Tiffany France thought her son would receive his diploma.
And I'm just trying to fight. He like, Mom, what was all this for? What did I do this for? Like, don't he get a chance? Do he get a chance?
But after 4 years of high school, this mom just learned her 17-year-old has to start over. He's been moved back to ninth grade.
Why would he do 3 more years in school? He didn't fail. The school failed him. The school failed at their job. They failed. They failed. That's the problem here. They failed. They failed. He didn't deserve that.
France's son attends Augusta Fells Savage Institute of Visual Arts in West Baltimore. His transcripts show in 4 years, he has passed just 3 classes, earning 2.5 credits, which places him in ninth grade. But France says she didn't know that until February. She has 3 children and works 3 jobs. She thought her oldest son was doing well because even though he failed most of his classes, he was being promoted. His transcripts show he failed Spanish 1 and Algebra 1, but was promoted to Spanish 2 and Algebra 2. He also failed English 2, but was passed on to English 3.
I'm just assuming that if you are passing, that you have the proper things, you know, to go to the next grade. And, you know, the right grades, you have the right credits.
As we dig deeper into her son's records, we can see in his first 3 years at Augusta Fells, he failed 22 classes and was late or absent 272 times. But in those 3 years, only one teacher requested a parent conference, which France says never happened. No one from the school told this mother her son was failing and not going to class.
Yeah.
France's son, in his 4 years at Augusta Fells, earned a grade point average of 0.13. He only passed 3 classes. But his transcripts show his class rank is 62 out of 120.
0.13, failed 22 of 25 classes over 3 years. And he's ranked right in the middle in his class. So that means half the class is below 0.13. Because this is a story about this kid, but it's a story about the system. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. By the way, Baltimore City Schools spend about $17,000 per pupil per year, which is more than most suburban high schools in Chicago. Tell me again about the K-12 system. Tell me again about wanting your kids to get back in school at all costs. Tell me again about how we should defer to teachers. They're all heroes. Tell me again how we should buy into the rhetoric from the politicians who are beholden to these teachers' unions. And oh, by the way, tell me again how everybody in the inner city is a victim. I'm sorry, but his mom, I know she's the report. According to the report, she's a single mom who has 3 jobs, 3 kids and 3 jobs. I appreciate
so
her difficulties.
The world.
I appreciate the difficulties that are in part per the choices she made in life. I mean, people have agency. I'm not going to patronize. And that reporter during the report, if you watch it on YouTube, he's got her son's academic records. He has screenshots of the report cards with F, 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 F. He's got a screenshot with his GPA and his class rank. So, yes, I can appreciate how the mom doesn't understand how he got passed along. But if you were just even looking at his report card, you may have asked yourself the same question years ago.
Well, that's when you have to be proactive and call the teachers and set up parent-teacher conferences.
Now listen,
ask them what's going on.
Well, I agreed. Exactly.
There's
now
no
listen to the school's response. The superintendent, who is a black female. I know, because this is all about white privilege. This is about underfunded city schools. This is about, you know, white conservatives who don't care. Right. The same white conservatives pushing school choice to get kids like this out of these schools and into schools like where I went that actually educate young people. Just remarkable. There's nothing that infuriates me more than this, and that it gets papered over in this culture by the race hustlers. I'm so sick of it. Listen to this school's response. She doesn't have the temerity to be interviewed, the school superintendent in the Boston City Schools, just like these hacks in Chicago. So they say they send a two-page letter full of lying and ass covering, of course.
We received this two-page statement, which explains what should happen when a student is chronically absent or failing. The district says students received a letter about their academic status this past summer, and records can be accessed through the campus portal. When a student is absent, an automated call is placed to the number on file. The statement also said the school conducted recent home visits, and the student's parent visited the school. But France says none of that happened. What this statement does not address is why France's son was promoted despite failing classes. It doesn't discuss his class rank or the 58 other students with a GPA of 0.13 or lower.
And her lament at the end of this piece, Miss France, Miss France's lament.
I would apologize profusely.
The end of that is a whistleblower. Just okay. So you get the end of that is a whistleblower from inside the central administration, the Politburo at the Baltimore City Schools, and then you get her, you know, because he's asked by the reporter, you know, what would you say to Miss France, and you know you hear his voice is scrambled because he's afraid of retaliation.
Well, of course,
the communists afraid of the communist Politburo. Yeah.
I would apologize profusely.
And he feels embarrassed, like he feels like a failure. And I'm like, you can't feel like that. And you have to be strong. And you gotta keep fighting. You know, life is about fighting. Things happen, but you gotta keep fighting. And he's willing. He's trying. But who would he turn to when the people that's supposed to help him is not? Who do he turn to?
Who do you turn to? Yeah, all the adults failed him, including his mom. I'm sorry.
Well, she did. She did. She has herself to blame, too.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
But how is Chicago Public Schools any different than this? Well, I mean, they pass kids, Dan, just to get them out of the way. Like, let's just keep having... And we know it because of this hybrid bull jive, which cannot go on next year. Because kids are cheating on homework and on tests, and they don't. There's no accountability.
What's the difference? I mean,
nobody's learning anything.
What percentage of the schools in the CPS in Chicago Public School System, in what percentage of the schools is the diploma worth anything? What percentage do you think?
5%.
Maybe.
Honestly.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, here's the thing, and for people who get put on their heels. To say you are supposed to write blank checks to school systems like CPS, otherwise you're racist or you don't care about poor kids, go frack yourself is what you should say to those people.
And go to empowerillinois.org.
That's right. And get help. And you're, exactly. Reference them as to the resources that can get their kid out of these schools. And reference the Baltimore story. And reference the myriad stories that we've done on this show about the endless scams that are run in CPS for years and years and years, from the superintendent on down, Barbara Bird Bennett.
Yeah.
Does anybody remember her? No, of course not. No institutional memory in this city.
She's still in jail, or she's getting out soon. Yeah.
You know, if you don't understand how indifferent these champagne socialists, these ghastly white champagne socialists in Naperville and Hinsdale and the North Shore are to the plight of black and brown families on the west and south sides of Chicago, then you understand nothing. And it's time, long overdue, actually, that it be called out for what it is relentlessly everywhere, including at cocktail parties, which is why I don't get invited to cocktail parties in those communities, because I've been at those cocktail parties and I've made those champagne socialists cry. Honest, literally.
Really?
Has happened when they are spouting their crap about Renaissance 2010. Remember that under Richie Daley and all the other great things they're doing to advance the blah, 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 blah. Go make love to yourself. Honestly. I just don't understand how people, particularly those who are being fleeced, their kids are being left behind. It doesn't begin to describe it. With that Tiffany Francis, where he's going to be. And this is, she just pulled him out of that school. She's got him in another city school. And now
and that's
maybe.
Going to make a difference?
Maybe by 2023, he can graduate high school. And maybe he comes out, I don't know. I don't know about this other school in Baltimore where she sent him. Maybe he comes out actually with some skill sets. I hope so for his sake. I mean, this is insane how this can persist in spite of all of the evidence, everything that people do know and otherwise should know. It's insane. And everybody runs around, education is the key to success. And, you know, education is the great equalizer. Prattling on your self-indulgent signaling and generations in the same school systems for 50 years are relegated to second, third-class citizen status for life. What does it take? Marianne and Wilmette.
Well, hi. First of all, I'm glad you made those people cry because in some of those situations, I wish I had the intestinal fortitude that you have and the brains to get back at these people. But that's one point, so huzzah to you. Another is I know as a working mom, I had to always manage my kids, and it's hard. I was a working mom, but I was lucky enough for them to go to Nutrier. Trust me. But there were some issues sometimes where I had to get involved. I had to take a day off, and I had to go talk to a teacher to figure out a plan. It wasn't, and my daughter had a health issue, so it wasn't like she was, I mean, she worked hard, but she had a health issue. But the point is, I had to go. I had to figure out, what's the plan? How are we going to do this? How are we going to help her? And I had to work. I had to do it. I had to manage it. And I hate to say you have to manage your kids, but you do. You can't just let them run free and not pay attention and read the damn, you know, their report cards. You've got to pay attention. Because if you don't really know what those teachers, again, they're good. They were good teachers, but you have to take responsibility for your kids and to make sure that they have the tools to develop and to become, you know, productive members of society. So I'm glad that you called her out. I felt like that at first, like when I first heard this story, I thought, well, what did the mom do? Felt bad about thinking that, but I'm glad you said it because I agree 100%.
Thanks, Marianne. Derek in Wheaton.
Yeah. Let me take the speaker off. Yeah, the answer is the teachers have to leave the union, but they're scared to death. They got to understand there's a union out there, the Association of American Educators, that'll give them the protections that they need. And that's one of the reasons they won't leave. They're just scared to death to leave the union because there's tons of teachers that don't agree with what's going on. And sadly, I'm sure you know about Marva Collins. The answer has been out there for years, the classical education. I'm a public school teacher, and we actually pulled our youngest, and my wife teaches at home, so I'm lucky to afford that. But it's a shame that the educational answers are out there, and we just keep doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
That's all I got.
Thanks for the call,
Derek. Thanks, Derek.
Appreciate that from perspective of a teacher. Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? You know, the schools here are obviously, you know, screwed up, but go figure. Where's the parent? I mean, you know, obviously, you know, she's got three jobs and stuff like she said, but...
Well, where's the dad? I mean, we're ripping on the mom. At least she's providing shelter and food.
Sure, I agree. That's a whole nother point. But, you know, the whole concept here is we're going to have a bunch of kids who are going to be behind. I'm involved in a thing that has a lot of online education, and there are standards for online education, and it works if you've done it properly, but they didn't. They just rushed into it, and, you know, the teachers, it's all gone down to the point that when we started thinking of teachers as a doctorate-level thing, it's garbage. There's really nothing new in teaching. It, as Aristotle said, it's a log with a teacher on one side and a student on the other. And when you get into all this highfalutin theory and all this other stuff and now the critical race theory and all these other indoctrination techniques, it's just a bunch of bull jive. And I agree with you. They should go be – they should just – they should be paid according to their – production, not according to just getting money, especially money because we're staying home because COVID and all this other stuff. And,
thanks for the call, Will. Look, this isn't highfalutin theory. That's not the problem. You were starting to get to part of the problem, which is the action civics, as it's now termed. And this is a whole practicum, action civics in K through 12. This is about training political agitators, not about educating children. And so who cares if you have a 0.13 GPA? In fact, the dumber you are, the less you know, the easier it is to just impute our propaganda into your head and have you go out and rinse and repeat it on the streets and everywhere else, you know, at your minimum wage job and so on and so forth. You know, be part of the, you know, we'll call you when it's time to put sandwich boards on for, you know, fight for a $50 minimum wage and so forth. That's what the action civics. I mean, that's what I say. Pay attention to the curriculum, not just the teacher, not just what your kid's doing, the curriculum, not just in the school, you know, Mary Ann from Wilmette, when maybe when she sent her kids to New Trier, it was a school similar to, you know, when Charlton Heston and Ann Margaret were there. But not that her kids are that old, but you know what I'm saying? These schools have reputations that no longer reflect what's going on inside their walls all over the place, including all over the suburbs. Joe in Franklin Park.
Yeah, you know, we have five kids, and there's no way, absolutely no way this would happen in our household. But, you know, it's going to be turned at, oh, it's because you're white privilege that your kids succeeded. And, Amy, I got to take umbrage with you that the mom was providing food and shelter. I'm going to bet my house that this kid was getting free food at the school. Which got to stop. If parents
we haven't hit school in a year.
Kids,
stop. We haven't hit school in a year.
It doesn't matter. They're still doing free lunch programs for people. If you can't feed your own kids, the school's not responsible for that. Educate the kids.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, continuing our K-12 talk, because if you care about the future of America, you care about the state of K-12 education in America. Setting the record straight on the food programs through the government school system, the family of every Chicago Public Schools student, regardless of income or citizenship, is set to receive more than $450 in the mail this month, plus hundreds more next month, April, to support food expenses. Mm-hmm. The program, Pandemic Electronic Benefits Transfer, an offshoot of the EBT system, is intended to help students who usually receive free or reduced price breakfast and lunch, but who haven't had access to in-school meals during the pandemic.
So you're saying I'm going to get some money?
Yeah, you are. Up to $450 this month, and another set of cards will be mailed in April with benefits for January through March, and then families will receive a monthly benefit starting in May for the rest of the school year. So, look, I'm not going to – this is questionable, but I'm not even going to argue that. If you were educating kids, it wouldn't bother me. I don't want to hear bitching about it now that we know what the truth is. But if you're educating kids, feeding kids from lower income households doesn't bother me at all. Fine, I'm happy to pay for that. I'm also happy to pay for that for kids from poor households who are going to private school on scholarship, places like Chicago Hope Academy, where they're coming from the same West Side families that are otherwise sending their kids to government schools, same socioeconomic demographics, And what's the conversation about their provision for food at school? No conversation. The hypocrisy of it all. You care about poor kids. No, you don't. No, you don't, you educrats and you champagne socialists and you race hustlers. You care about the system that benefits you and your adult friends, your fellow travelers. That's what you care about. And don't tell me otherwise, because the evidence is overwhelmingly on my side. Now, with respect to the state of K through 12 education post-COVID in these same inner cities and suburban districts, Naperville, Deerfield, it just as teachers union dominated as Chicago is, as we've seen from the extent of their shutdowns. Robbie Sauve has a good piece that was posted over again at Barry Weiss's Substack. She's posting some good guest op-eds about the extent of this. Over the past 12 months, Sauve, who's otherwise Reason Magazine, over the past 12 months, an estimated 18 million kids haven't set foot inside of a classroom or have just started coming back for one day a week. That's about one-third of all public school students, which number about 50 million. 18 million haven't set foot inside a classroom in a year. And, of course, this was entirely avoidable, but not when adults genuflect before those who have seized control of their schools and their children's future. And apparently they're fine with it. A lot of them are, at least. So what does going back to school look like?
Oh, it's hell. I talked to a fourth grader yesterday, Dan, and my heart sank. I said, so how was it? Aren't you so excited? He said, no. I mean, we can't talk during lunch because our masks are off so that we could eat. And I said, well, you know, how was it in the lunchroom with the lunchroom lady? And he said, no, we sit in our classrooms. We can't leave. It's miserable. He said, I feel like I'm in prison. And I don't think that's why it's 2 days a week. They're not going to go back. He's not going back. I mean, it's hell. Honestly, what the hell are we doing? We fought for this for 2 days, and you can't go to the – you have to go – you know, even if you have to go to the bathroom, you have to wait. Somebody has to disinfect the bathroom before you walk in. It's such craziness.
Well, that's not what I understand from the LI Unified School District.
What?
They've posted a video about the forthcoming partnership with Microsoft to have day passes so that you can attend school safely. And, of course, it's all glorious when you're finally allowed back in the building. This is Bertolt Brecht quality agitprop you're about to hear. Listen.
There's never been anything like this virus in our lifetime. Often, it's hard to see the effects it's having on our children. Has this conversation taken place in your home?
Mom, I'm scared about going back to school. I don't want to get sick, and I don't want to get you and Dad sick.
Our scientists tell us there are three things we must do to stay safe. Wear masks, make sure we social distance, and wash our hands. And now, your school, with the help of Microsoft Corporation, has created another. Introducing Daily Pass. Your exclusive ticket for safely going back to school.
What?
Each week, you can schedule your free on-campus COVID test. The results are displayed in your daily pass. And if you choose to take your test off campus, you can post the results in your daily pass. And the moment vaccinations are available, you'll simply be able to schedule yours through your daily pass. But the real magic is your daily health check. Just answer a few simple health questions every day, and like magic, your entrance ticket appears.
Think of the carnival ride.
Welcome back.
Is there cotton candy included with this?
Welcome to school.
I might get sick.
You have to watch it, too, to really appreciate lobotomizing it is.
Mom, I'm skiing.
A little bit more happy horse pucky.
So, how did it go?
Dad.
Dad, I have to admit, I was scared at first, but then I felt so safe. It was so good to be back. Thanks for keeping me safe. I love you so much.
Do Microsoft and your school district combining for the daily pass with your daily test and your daily questionnaire. And everybody is going to submit to the safetyists, right? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. If the L.A. Unified School District is putting out that, as I said, Bertolt Brechtian propaganda, you can bet it's coming to Chicago and to suburban school districts and to big cities all over the country, because they're still teachers union run. They haven't been chastened.
I honestly feel sick right now.
It is sickening.
This is a communist country we're living in.
Orwell, Bradbury, Huxley, they didn't have creative enough imaginations to conceive what is actually taking place. Pete in Montgomery.
Dan, I got a little sick in my mouth there. That was scary. Can I stay home from work today?
As long as you file your day pass, I'll let you stay home from work, Pete. Thanks for the call. Tom in Midlothian.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, after it became clear that the statistics were against this virus back in April, I've told my children, you don't have to worry about this virus. We wear the masks to make people feel good because I put them in Catholic school. And that commercial makes me viscerally sick.
Yeah.
And I'm just disappointed in the leadership and also a small percentage of the society that is scared to death, because it's just it's ridiculous.
Thanks, Tom.
And don't think it is already happening here. I mean, to go in to volunteer or to even go into the high school, you have to fill out a form online, a health screener check, and then you get this code, and that's how you get in the school.
Do you get the theme music with that?
No, I don't. Which, you know, I'm feeling a little left out.
Dawn in Plainfield.
Where's the Illinois State Board of Education in all this?
Hilarious.
I hear all of you are blaming the school districts. The school districts aren't in charge. According to the law, the No Child Left Behind Act was replaced by Obama by the ESSA. Go look up the ISBE and how they're mandating the ESSA. That's the main rule that guides K-12 education. So we need to hold them accountable, too, not just the districts.
Okay, fine. Thanks for the call, Don. That's fine. You can, you know, throw them all into the same cauldron. That's fine with me. But if I'm the superintendent of a school district, if I'm a school board member, if I'm a teacher, you think I'm going to be afraid to go against the Illinois State Board of Education and those appointed hacks? No, that does not absolve the school district. It does not absolve the staff, administrative, and the teachers. It does not absolve the parents. It absolves no one. So, yes, all the layers of bureaucracy, fine. Rope them all together. Nobody is absolved. And all that does is, you know, I'm not responsible. I'm not accountable. Oh, so you got to go up the food chain. The hell with that. At some point, somebody has to take ownership of their lives and their kids' lives. You think? Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, one of the problems with just schools in general today is that there's too much of a focus on reading and writing skills. I mean, every class becomes reading and writing skills. Like, I teach history. It's, you know, these DBQs, the document-based questions. The kids hate them. I shouldn't say they hate them, but I mean, a lot of them, you know, it's just boring over and over and over again. Not enough surveying of civilization. Not enough surveying of our literature, of our, you know, our classical education. It's and I blame conservatives so much for that, because everybody's got to read, write, you know, and all that stuff. But you know, kids need a broad education is what they need. And now we wonder why they don't know anything. You know, the AP U.S. history has gone, they only cover 8 presidents now. That's it. There's no broad survey of U.S. history anymore.
Yeah, I agree with that, Frank. But the problem is that in so many districts, you have to fight to get to read, writing, and arithmetic, much less this broad, you know, classical liberal education. You can't even get there because all you have is, to borrow a phrase, illiterate revolutionaries that are weaned on action civics.
Well, maybe that's the case. But, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of the kids feel some of this stuff is boring. I really do.
Boring,
you
know, yeah.
I mean, look, I'm all with you with respect to the destination. The problem is the starting point. Thanks for the call, Frank. Janine on the south side.
Hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. After listening to that video, I noticed the child used the term dad, and I thought we were getting away from those gender-specific terms. I was kind of offended by that.
Yeah, sure, very offensive.
And
no question.
I think if Chicago did a version of that, I think the Rona Busters would do a bang-up job as starring in the film.
Oh, so, yeah, they're back. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Janine.
That would be, to feature them.
They could act it out.
Yeah, because they did do a dance last time, remember? They did a little...
Oh, how could I forget?
It was 10 seconds long, 10 seconds I'll never forget.
Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning, guys. I bring up that referencing that kid before, that kid that's failing.
In Baltimore?
You know, maybe he had dyslexia. My wife sees it in first grade as the teacher, and... The school districts will not diagnose, even at an early age, dyslexia. And these kids go years and years before the school does anything because they have to open up an IEP and create resources. And so how often are kids pushed into high school have dyslexia struggle?
Perhaps, Chris, but 58 kids of his 120-person class had GPAs lower than 0.12. They all had dyslexia?
No, I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just saying what's wrong with the school district is that
they don't want to diagnose. They don't want the extra work,
create money. Exactly.
Yeah, they don't want the extra work. They don't want the resource drain. Thanks for the call, Chris. Right, because it's about them. It's not about the kids. Right, exactly. Another manifestation of that. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Morning.
Dan, amazing rant on education. I love it. But here's something I don't really understand.
Hey, Candace, you have to talk into the receiver.
Oh, sorry. I don't understand why people don't realize that this song and this vaccine thing is an apparatchik itself. And, I mean, I don't understand why people can't do the simplest research, you know, listen to like Kathleen Humphreys, who's a doctor who saw way too many people die from vaccine-related toxicity to their kidneys and livers. I don't understand. Kids do not need this. They don't get COVID. This is insane.
Well, some kids do get COVID.
Thanks, Candace.
But they don't know that they have COVID, and they have to get tested to see if they have a deadly disease. It's a joke.
Terry in Rogers Park.
Teachers should notify parents when they see a child is failing. But these days, they believe in not making failing kids feel bad.
It's all about self-esteem, right, Terry? Thanks for the call. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and New York Governor Party Nips gave another run at an apology. This is second try. See if you think he was any more successful than in his first try.
First, I fully support a woman's right to come forward. And I think it should be encouraged in every way. I now understand that I acted in a way that made people feel uncomfortable. It was unintentional. And I truly and deeply apologize for it. I feel awful about it. And frankly, I am embarrassed by it. And that's not easy to say. But that's the truth. But this is what I want you to know. And I want you to know this from me directly. I never touched anyone inappropriately.
Really? Because that's how you greet people, though, Governor Cuomo.
You can go find hundreds of pictures of me kissing people. men, women. It is my usual and customary way of greeting.
Yeah.
The problem with that is there are many problems with that. And by the way, I would have expected a better performance from an International Emmy Award winner.
Yes, please step up your game, sir.
The third accuser is all over the New York Post and other outlets. Picture from the wedding with Cuomo's hands on her cheeks. Ooh. This is somebody who didn't know nipple studs before that wedding. And that picture, to me, lends a lot of credibility to her suggestion that he put his hand on the small of her back and she had to swat it away. Right. And then grabbed her by the cheeks, which we see pictured, and tried to kiss her, saying, "Can I kiss you?" And she turned away.
And the look on his face, though, that aggressive look, like he's biting his lower lip, that says a lot, too.
And by the way, just as a quick aside, I've been trying to figure out who he sounds like since we've had to endure so much of
his whining
pablum over the last few weeks.
Who?
He sounds a little bit like Christopher Walken. Not exactly Christopher Walken, but more like Jay Moore doing a Christopher Walken impersonation.
It's good to be here. At my age, it's good to be anywhere. That was a joke.
And, you know, the same madcap sense of humor, which was the effort he made in his first non-apology to chalk this up to his just zany way of joking around with subordinates. So how is this playing? Well, Newsmax did a little man on the street outside Grand Central Station and asked random New Yorkers, some who support Cuomo, you'll hear why, if they think Cuomo should resign.
Andrew Cuomo, should he resign?
Absolutely.
Why do you say that?
The sooner the better. He's the worst governor in the history of the state. Usually where there's smoke, there's fire, I find.
Who do you trust more, Andrew Cuomo or Chris Cuomo?
Neither.
Should he resign? What do you think?
I like Cuomo.
Why do you like him?
Because he's Italian. I'm Italian.
Rudy Giuliani was too.
I don't like him. Sorry.
Boo. Bye, Cuomo. Bye, Andy.
They have to wait for the investigation.
There should be an investigation first.
No, he shouldn't resign. I don't think so.
Should he retire? Should go to jail?
Sorry, dude. You f***ed up.
Governor Andrew Cuomo, should he resign?
Yes.
Should he resign? Should he be impeached? What are your thoughts?
I think he should. I think there needs to be an investigation, to be fair about it.
It's not looking good for him. He's gonna need women to come out in his defense. I mean, Melissa DeRosa. You know, she should be speaking out for him. I mean, that's the only way he's going to be saved.
What is your biggest concern? Is it the sexual harassment allegations or what he did with the nursing homes?
There's a long list.
Cuomo had no problem getting his brother on there with the prop and the fake Q-tip and laughing it up. It would be like, you know, Giuliani being on CNN laughing it up while bodies burned in the buildings on September 11th. Guy's writing a book about leadership. Guy has audacity.
Audacity indeed. Oh, by the way, on Cuomo, the Intrepid Pointer Institute, you know, upholding the canons of journalism, you know, as a last resort, has now weighed in and said, oh, you know, Fredo Cuomo, they didn't use Fredo, he shouldn't have interviewed, he shouldn't have had Brother Nipple Studs on the show. Because now that he won't have him on the show, it shows a real conflict of interest. Conflict of interest having on the show, and then the double standard not having him on the show now to field questions about both scandals. Yeah. The Pointer Institute.
Oh, good for you.
What a joke. And the Pointer Institute and their lethargy in responding to examples of hackery. Well, in a supposed journalistic circles is exactly why journalism is a punchline these days.
Yeah, I mean, it was an act. I mean, when he was single, you know, he was trying to find him love because he was the love gov.
Want a pat on the back?
Love gov?
Even if it's the love gov from New York.
Do you think that you are an attractive person now because you're single and ready to mingle? Do you really think you are some desirable single person and that this is not just people's pain coming out of them?
Love gov?
I've always been a soft guy. I am the love gov. I'm a cool dude in a loose mood. You know that.
Yeah.
I mean, he used his platform on CNN to try to get his brother hooked up with a chick.
Oh, please. Whatever.
It was just ridiculous.
Those two
and
that ridiculous vaudeville act. And now we're supposed to take him seriously and we're supposed to believe his a passive-aggressive statement of contrition, please. Honestly. By the way, the bigger issue, which was mentioned by some of those New Yorkers that were interviewed for that MOS piece, don't let this subsume the nursing home issue, because that is the bigger issue. Based on just the allegations we know so far from the women, it's a serious issue, fine. But it is not the sending sick people back into nursing homes and then covering it up. It is, doesn't rise to that level. That is the real crime here. And this is why you have so many left in the media saying, oh, we need to hold Cuomo accountable so they can't accuse us of double standards like our friend Jeet Hare over at New Republic. Yeah, the nursing home scandal, the COVID-related performance, Mr. Bestseller, that's Mr. International Emmy with the wonderful press conferences. That is the fundamental issue as far as a reason for to force his resignation or move his impeachment. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Chris Smith, author of The Daily Show, the book, An Oral History as Told by Jon Stewart, the correspondent's staff and guests. He's also a contributing editor at New York Magazine and contributor to Vanity Fair. Chris, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Morning. So you've penned a piece on Governor Cuomo as well, and suggesting that his canonization may have been a bit too early, or certainly it is making the fall that much greater.
Yeah, I'll answer that question certainly, but two things from your lead-in there. Props to the men and women in the street who were interviewed by Newsmax, who knew incredible detail about New York politics, including members of the governor's staff. That was impressive.
Yeah.
Second, Christopher Walken is a good comparison.
Yeah, thank also, you.
also a Queens guy like Governor Cuomo.
He also does that thing, not to get too far down this rabbit hole, but he also does the thing that Walken does, which is turn one-syllable words into two-syllable words.
Oh, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. I once ran into Christopher Walken in an elevator, but that's a different story, so we'll do that some other time. Anyway, yes, as I wrote back in, God, seems like forever ago, May of 2020 in Vanity Fair, the governor, while a lot of people appreciated his daily press conferences and his verbal sort of hand-holding through the early and middle days of the pandemic, you know, there were a lot of holes in his policy response to it, even at that time, and he was being canonized in a lot of the media. Certainly his public approval ratings were soaring. And as we know from public life, from politics, you know, what goes up must come down. And it came after a long history of the governor, abusing people, intimidating them, not physically, but for many, many years, you know, screaming, yelling, transferring, all sorts of things that are, you know, sharp-elbowed politics, but that had left him with no reservoir of goodwill in New York or national political circles for the most part. And that's coming back to haunt him loud and clear now.
Well, he said yesterday that he's not going to resign. His lawyers begged him not to go forward yesterday and have a press conference, but he did anyway. So what's next? I mean, if he refuses to resign and digs in his heel, and you have 21 lawmakers that want him to resign, what can they do?
Yeah, I mean, certainly an impeachment mechanism exists in state government here. We're nowhere near that actually coming into play. Those lawmakers who've come out and called for him to resign, the vast majority of them are either running for mayor of New York City and dislike him in general, or are to the left members of the state legislature. You know, not that they don't have legitimate, genuine complaints about the governor, but their political agendas at work there as well. You know, this sounds cynical, but in working in the governor's favor is time. You know, investigations take time. And the more distance he can put between these immediate accusations and running the government, you know, showing that he's getting back to work and delivering from people, you know, the better it is for him. The big
so long as there aren't more allegations.
Absolutely. This is what his staff and him, I'm sure, are holding their breaths about. Yes, if anyone else comes forward and has really detailed, credible accusations, that would be highly damaging. But the governor's not going anywhere anytime soon voluntarily. He's going to be negotiating a state budget over the next month, and that gives him, you know, he's got a lot of power there to both punish and reward people who may want to move against him.
It's interesting. There's the operatives I've talked to who know the New York political landscape much better than I are sort of divided on this. They all agree that what you were saying, that Cuomo has no friends, and this goes back to his days as the political enforcer for his father. He's been rubbing people the wrong way and not making friends and influencing people for a long time. But there's divided opinion whether this is particularly a parochial matter about Andrew Cuomo, or this is in part a local matter and in part a national matter. And it's Democrats at the federal level wanting to keep him in New York or derail him altogether because of his national ambitions, and perhaps even some have theorized that this is a dress rehearsal for what Democrats may do with respect to Joe Biden if he doesn't hew the orthodoxy of the party and where the energy is in the party, that the idea that, hey, you have these old allegations too that we can bring forward, and maybe there are others that we can bring forward, and this is sort of a sort of Damocles hanging over Joe Biden's head the way that it was hanging over Andrew Cuomo's head until it got cut.
That's interesting. I find it a bit of a reach, you know. Okay. Certainly the people who've broken the stories in New York, you know, it's all over the map. The New York Times broke one of the big stories. The New York Post broke a lot of huge nursing home related stories. Cuomo's national ambitions, while he's certainly had them for a long time, have always been pretty unrealistic. They're, you know, at zero now, given the past few weeks. But he knew, and I think a lot of people in national Democratic politics knew, that he wasn't going to D.C. He almost certainly was never going to be running for president. So nobody, you know, on the national scene, he doesn't have a lot of friends. People are not unhappy to see him in the barrel, so to speak, at the moment. But I don't think anybody was particularly worried about him challenging them on a national level. What's more, internal politics, you know, in New York, and you have it, I'm sure, in Illinois and elsewhere, there are plenty of people in state politics who'd love to see him leave the job simply so they can move up, you know, sure, because he's had a stranglehold on state government for almost 12 years now and wants it to be for 16 years. And, you know, there's a lot of highly ambitious younger people who would like to see the deck shuffled a bit.
Well, does anybody care about the nursing home investigation? I mean, you have those 21 lawmakers that came forward, but where are they upset about that or about the nursing home deaths?
Yeah, you know, sure, there are a great many people upset about the nursing home scandal, and there are investigations going on there as well. Obviously, in the past 10 days, 2 weeks, that's been dwarfed in terms of media coverage by the sexual harassment accusations. You know, you certainly can't say that the newest scandal is good news for Cuomo, but it has put the nursing home stuff on the back burner. That's not going away. You know, when you're talking about thousands of people who maybe didn't need to get sick or die, that's the kind of thing that resonates with the public. And we don't have all the facts on that, and there are investigations continuing.
Well, I, for one, certainly hope he survives. I certainly hope he survives, because he may be the only thing that can get a Republican elected governor in New York State if he were to be the nominee again election time.
It cuts a lot of ways. I mean, because you talk to people in the business community here who, while, you know, on a personal level, they're not any fans of the governor, see him as the only thing standing in the way between the state legislature passing a bunch of tax hikes on rich people and spending a lot more money, you know, that he's been a moderating influence in terms of state government. So, you know, there's a lot of conflicting currents at the moment around the governor.
He is Chris Smith, author of The Daily Show, the book, An Oral History as Told by Jon Stewart, the correspondents, staff, and guests, and contributing editor at New York Magazine and at Vanity Fair. Chris, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity. This afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
And Amy found out from Equity Toolkit being promulgated by the Educrats in Arizona.
Yeah.
That white babies become racist as young as 3 months old.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a memory from when you were 3 months old, Dan? No, nobody does.
Sure, but that's how pernicious being white is. You don't even realize you're racist because you can't remember being 3 years old, but it's hardwired into your DNA. That's the position of the left. The toolkit teaches, among other things, that babies start to become racist at just 3 months of age. The toolkit insists that babies must be spoken to about race as, quote, letting children draw their own conclusions based on what they are, unquote, leads to racism.
I mean, you can't eat, you can't control your bowels, but you can control your beliefs at 3 months old. Okay,
The Equity Toolkit also suggests white children specifically are stronger biased in favor of their own race by the time they are 5 years old, but claimed that such a phenomenon does not exist among black and Latinx children.
No,
of course it
Latinos.
Doesn't. Which brings me to a very interesting piece by Eric Levitz in New York Magazine. And this is an interview he did, in part informed by an interview he did with David Shore, who is a progressive Democrat operative. He was part of the Obama 2012 campaign. He runs a leftist nonprofit now. And the Republican Party has the prospect to be a lot stronger than some people might think. And it's largely because of Trump. This is an analysis, a threat assessment essentially from the left, which is interesting. And by the way, it's interesting also how much more accurate a depiction of the landscape, and this is data-driven, you get from a David Shore, a leftist operative, than you do from the establishment Republican Party. Interesting. He writes, even if a majority of non-white people agreed with liberals on all these issues, the fundamental problem is that Democrats have been relying on the support of roughly 90% of black voters and 70% of Hispanic voters. So if the Democrats elevate issues or theories that a large minority of non-white voters reject, it's going to be hard to keep those margins, because these issues are strongly correlated with ideology. And black conservatives and Hispanic conservatives don't actually buy into a lot of these intellectual theories of racism. They often have a very different conception of how to help the black or Hispanic community than liberals do. And I don't think we can buy our way out of this trade-off. Most voters are not liberals. If we polarize the electorate on ideology, or if nationally prominent Democrats raise the salience of issues that polarize the electorate on ideology, we're going to lose a lot of votes. Basically, we have this small window right now to pass redistricting reform and create states. And if we don't use this window, we will almost certainly lose control of the federal government and not be in a position to pass laws again, potentially for a decade. In terms of putting numbers on things, I think if we implemented D.C. and Puerto Rican statehood and passed redistricting reform, that would roughly triple our chances of holding the House in 2022 and roughly the same in the Senate. So Donald Trump is unpopular, he goes on, and he does pay a penalty of that. He does pay a penalty for that relative to a generic Republican. But the voters he's popular with happen to be extremely efficiently distributed in a political in political geography terms. So I think the Trump era has been very good for the Republican Party, even if they now momentarily have to accept this very, very, very thin Democratic trifecta. Because if this coalition change, if the coalition changes are durable that he's describing, the GOP has very rosy long-term prospects for dominating America's federal institutions. Isn't that an interesting perspective? It seems to be like the one we've been offering for some time on this show with respect to Trump reshuffling the deck and with respect to the takeaways, even in defeat in November, of increasing the percentage of Black and Latino voters at the presidential level. Now, even regaining control and regaining and enjoying dominance of the federal institutions, if David Shore were to be proven correct, that doesn't necessarily mean we know what Republicans will do, and it doesn't necessarily immediately translate into regaining balance, if not control, of all the cultural institutions dominated by the left. So this is a long fight. But it is interesting that you have a political operative on the left offering real concern about the hegemony of Republicans short of moving D.C. and Puerto Rican statehood and redistricting reform as sort of contained in that part of that contained in the legislation that passed the House yesterday. Very interesting. For more on all of this and well, a couple other topics, too, including one she's written about recently about presidential vernacular, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Amity Schles, board chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, winner of the Hayek Prize and bestselling author of The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression and Great Society, A New History. Amity, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Before we get to your piece about the use of the word great or the overuse of it, particularly at the presidential level, what about the political landscape as you're hearing David Shore describe it in that piece in New York Magazine I mentioned, and just your own handle on what you think it is right now?
Well, you know, generally the left is more afraid of the right and more confident in the conservative or common sense values power to win American votes than the right is. That's what's interesting, right? Republicans are kind of rambling all over the place, trying to sound like Democrats often on the minimum wage, for example, or with the child allowance of Senator Romney. That's just Democrat light. And but Republicans like to Democrats like to get Republicans out of their traditional position because it's such a good one. We have an article, the co-editor of this Coolidge autobiography and I coming out about how Gerald Ford was tricked and Jimmy Carter did real well on it by taking the empty space on Gerald Ford's right. It's a bit like basketball or any other sport. When you hit tennis, you leave the space open foolishly, someone else is going to take it. Of course, Jimmy Carter wasn't a right-wing guy, but in the election, he played the right, and that helped him to win. And that was after a scandal, too, of course. But I want to say one other thing vis-a-vis suppression and the general mood. Even Calvin Coolidge has been suppressed. We had a Facebook tweet of a Calvin Coolidge quote where he said, presidents shouldn't talk a lot because sometimes when they talk, that fomented hatred and jealousy. And this Facebook refused to allow us to promote.
Well,
he's supposed to be milquetoast, right?
Well, his nickname is Silent Cal, and they're going to make sure he lives down to that nickname, Silence. No, nothing from Calvin Coolidge.
The left sometimes understands the power of the right, and I don't mean the evil right. I mean the common sense, strong right that understands government spending too much money or that extreme versions of affirmative action, intersectionality aren't good for Black or white. You know, most people kind of understand that. So, and the left gets that most people kind of aren't that crazy.
Well,
that they're going to worry about their words to this extent. You know, we're all in the same country and we generally want to help one another.
Well, somebody that seems to get that, even if you don't always agree with his rhetorical choices, is Trump. And it was an interesting piece by Dan Henninger in the Journal about that and about his CPAC speech on Sunday, which is still being dissected. And he just pulled a lot of what Trump said in terms of policy vision for the Republican Party, the way forward for the Republican Party, including but not limited to Trump. And Henninger makes the point that, you know, amid some of the bluster and unique communication style is a lot of stuff that were that was popularized during Reagan. He quotes him. It means low taxes and eliminating job killing regulations, Trumpism. It means, let me just finish.
Could I pick a bone with you on that?
Well, let me just finish what Henninger cites, and then I'll let you pick that bone. It means strong borders. It means no riots in the streets. It means very strong protection of the Second Amendment. It means support for the forgotten men and women who've been taken advantage of for so many years. It means a strong military, and so on and so forth. So, go ahead, pick that bone.
Well, actually, first I'll say that's what Calvin Coolidge was for, and that's how come he won. I came on because I really like this book. I'm writing an intro to an old autobiography. It was published in 1929 by Calvin Coolidge, but it is the best primer on common sense for your kids. Because Coolidge wrote great. He wrote short, clear sentences. He had beautiful homiletic prose. And he just told the story of what America was and how he rose in it. And what he did is necessary, and here comes the bone. Coolidge actually saved government money. He actually cut the budget, and he actually cut taxes dramatically. And my point is just that taxes and cutting the government can't be like a throwaway line behind a child credit. It has to be these ideas, the basic principles of American growth, have to be number one. So it's up to other Republicans to seriously take very, very seriously the fight about the capital gains tax, for example. Other people say, oh, yeah, that's a rich person's tax, so let's raise it. It is not a rich person's tax. It is a tax on job creation in the United States. And so, I mean, I don't think there's an economist even on the far left, Dan and Amy, who would deny that if you cut the U.S. capital gains rate to 2%, you would have an ocean of international money and an ocean of activity here in the United States that would provide jobs for everyone and educational training for those who want it and need it. So they're just scared to say cut capital gains because, oh, that sounds like we're serving the rich. Oh, my God. So we have to be a little bit more leaderly on this and not cower behind social measures pretending that they are economic growth optimal.
I'm glad you picked that bone because I'm in complete agreement. Absolutely. Trump is a failure on the spending side like so many Republicans for so many generations.
One thing about Coolidge after the scandal, which they had a terrible scandal in the 20s, Teapot Dome, and you're like, I can't even remember what that is, right? Well, Teapot Dome got at the heart of the Republican goals because the Republicans were for privatization in that time after a big war and a big government, World War One. So they said, let's put oil in private hands to be managed. So you're saying you want to privatize or lease to private parties in that instance? You better privatize right and not just give out the money like Vladimir Putin to your friends.
Right.
And yet the Harding administration did that. That's why Teapot Dome matters. It besmirched free market principles and the very idea that the private sector could do a good job with such projects. So Coolidge became president when Harding died all of a sudden, and he had to clean all this up. And the way that he did it was he hewed to the policy written in the platform. So my own view is this is a good year for Republicans to write a real platform and take it seriously and put markets on the top because they don't know what they think, and that means it's all about personalities, and you can't go forever on personalities. President Trump or not, you know, you have got to have something truly bold and actually show you believe in it.
Absolutely. And also you have to stop starting from the premises of the left and trying to meet them a half or a third of the way, which you've seen Mitt Romney and other senators do on the minimum wage, which you've seen them do on spending hundreds of billions, if not trillions more of government funny money, which you've seen them talk about doing on a range of issues, too. Then you're always advancing their flag just more slowly. And there's little distinction.
Just more slowly. Right? I agree. Well, yeah, and that's what happened with Ford after another scandal, Watergate. He was so eager to be in the center. He was a really good, you know, Ford understood the Senate and the House very, very well. That's where he came from, the Hill. And so he went political rather than economic. He was also, remember, the whip inflation now buttons. He also was wrong on economics. That hurt, too. But you don't want a Ford situation. You want a Coolidge situation, and this little book explains, you know, all about that. Coolidge, by the way, was pretty wonderful on civil rights
he when a black man tried to run for office in New York State, a Republican wrote Coolidge and said, we can't allow this. And Coolidge published a response in the paper saying, I said, I'm just amazed you even dare to say that. I saw the black troops come home from World War One. They were wounded. We didn't have antibiotics. I mean, you can imagine what it was like to come back from World War One with a festering wound. And they might not be able to work their whole lives, and they all served so nobly. So, but Coolidge was for border restrictions, which is interesting. He said America needs a time to settle. The people who are here need to settle. We're all in the same boat here, and we have to help one another. But that doesn't mean we can always absorb everyone all the time. He was not a free immigration person. So that's kind of interesting, too, for those who have that view.
She is Amity Schles, and it's always an education with her, board chair of the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, winner of the Hayek Prize, best-selling author of books including The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression, and Great Society, A New History. Amity, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
I'm thrilled to be there.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the defund the police movement got some additional momentum yesterday with the House passing legislation that now has to go over to the Senate. This has a high hurdle yet to clear, as it passed with just the required number of Democrat votes to get it over to the Senate side. But it essentially does at the federal level what you see moving at state and local levels, including in Chicago, to impose mandates on police departments that, according to House Republican Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, would result in the loss of 3,000 police officers from the streets around the country because of the mandates that would be imposed on local police departments per this federal legislation. But this is the impetus of the defund the police movement. Do through mandates what you can't necessarily do simply through budget cutting. And this was a topic of conversation back at the height of the civil unrest and violence throughout America last summer into the fall. June of 2020, The Daily Show hosted a roundtable discussion on Black Lives Matter and the Defund the Police movement. This has been recommended for viewing by educators. I mentioned the other week, suburban Chicago, the alma mater of one Hillary Clinton, Maine East High School, recommended the teachers watch this roundtable discussion, which included, among others, Brooklyn College sociology professor Alex Vitale on abolishing the police. And here's what Professor Vitale had to say.
It's really more about a process driven by a set of principles than it is some predetermined outcome. I think what we're seeing on the streets today when people say defund the police, yes, it's about these immediate changes that Patrice is talking about, but it's also about a generation of young people, you know, crying out for a world that isn't driven by racial and class inequalities that are enforced by policing. And the sad truth is that that has been the role that police have played in American society, and enforcers of systems that produce these inequalities. And every time we turn a problem over to them, it makes those inequalities worse in the long run. Mm-hmm. So police abolition is about trying to reduce the burden of policing today while we work to build something better for the future.
For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Professor Alex Vitale, Professor of Sociology and Coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Movement at Brooklyn College. He's also the author of the book, The End of Policing. Professor, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan.
Develop this end of policing thesis. I've read a good portion of your book. and what the end of policing would give birth to in terms of the way to preserve order in a free society.
Well, thanks for having me on, Dan. And, you know, first I want to say that actually I'm not a big fan of the House bill. I don't think it particularly is consistent with the defund the police movement. Well, it's not only that it doesn't go far enough, it doesn't approach the problem in the right way. In fact, some of these mandates that you're concerned about are mandates that I don't agree with either.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to fix policing with implicit bias training or de-escalation training. You know, the officers involved in the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis had all that training, were wearing body cameras. They had all the changes to use of force policies, and it just didn't matter. It just didn't make a difference. The evidence is pretty clear that a lot of these mandates don't work. And I don't think the problem with policing in the United States can be, you know, captured by just saying, well, cops are racist, and if we just give them sensitivity training, that this is going to fix it. I think this is not the way to understand the problem. I think the way to understand the problem is to say, look, we've turned every social problem under the sun over to the police to manage. We've both made these problems worse, like mass homelessness, mass untreated mental health and substance abuse problems, failed schools. And then when those problems emerge, we say, well, let's give that all to the police. And I think even a lot of police understand that this is a mistake. They don't want to be in the mental health business. They don't want to be in the homeless outreach business. They don't want to really be in charge of youth discipline in schools. And so the defund the police movement is saying, look, we need to rethink our budget priorities. Instead of increasing the police budget every year, maybe we need to put more resources into school counselors, into community-based mental health services, into Housing First programs, into high-quality drug treatment. And that's really the key demand of this movement. And the bill that passed in Washington doesn't do any of that.
Well, how do you feel about social workers showing up for domestic violence calls with police officers?
Well, I would rather see preventative services in the communities, family crisis centers, so that we don't have so many 911 calls. And then we should have an ability to assess whether or not sending a police officer at all is in fact the right decision in a case-by-case basis. We're doing that in some cities already around things like mental health crisis calls, and there are some examples in different places of how we might reduce the police role on domestic violence calls as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of argument about reining in the mission creep that has occurred with policing that you're describing. I think the issue is the defund and police abolition movement, which my sense is that you're generally supportive of, and how that would impact the core mission of policing, which is the solving and to some extent the prevention of violent crime in particular.
So I think there's been a kind of intentional misrepresentation of the movement. You know, no one who's really doing this work on the ground imagines that there's some magical switch that they can flip and tomorrow, poof, you know, all police will be gone. This is about a process of interrogating the scope of policing and trying to implement evidence-based alternatives in as many arenas as we can, including a lot of arenas around violence. We have a growing body of research that shows that community-based anti-violence strategies can be much more effective at policing in reducing shootings and homicides. These are things like credible messenger movements, hospital-based trauma counseling. There are a lot of different, including changes to physical design issues, improving street lighting. There's a real sense that we can't just, you know, flip the switch and tomorrow there are no police, but we can begin to invest in alternatives to policing, and we can pursue that process as far as we can reasonably go with that.
Well, do you then concede that the evidence suggests that the number of police has a effect on crime, especially violent crime? And when crime soars, not only do direct victims suffer, but you run the risk of cities or neighborhoods, if not cities generally, unraveling.
So the defund the police movement is a public safety movement that is led overwhelmingly by people from communities with high levels of violence and other kind of crime, and for whom policing has not been an adequate strategy for them. So they're trying to figure out investments in community-based strategies that will make them safer than they are now. The research on police effectiveness is very mixed. And even the few studies that show, oh, well, we increased a few officers here and we got a 3% reduction in burglaries or something, that doesn't mean that if we add 10,000 more officers, we'll get a 10 times bigger reduction in crime. There's absolutely no evidence to support that.
Well,
and there's no correlation between the number of police officers per capita and crime rates, and there never has been such a correlation.
Well, but perhaps there's diminishing marginal returns at some point. I don't know exactly what that point is, but I do know, I mean, there was a study done in 2018 by a couple of academics that looked at police and crime data from large and mid-sized cities for a 50-year period, 1960 to 2010, and they estimated that for every dollar spent on extra police generated about $1.63 in social benefits, primarily by reducing murders. And I ask again about whether or not you believe that policing is the appropriate mechanism to try to solve, and by solving, prevent violent crimes.
So there are several problems with that study, which was done by some economists who have actually no experience with policing or public safety. First of all, that cost-benefit calculation assumes that a life saved is worth some magically made-up dollar figure, which is around $5 million.
Well, lifetime
and
earnings.
And then it does nothing, but that this is not actually the lifetime earnings of most of the people who are killed, unfortunately. But also, this is a kind of perverse way of thinking about it. The other thing is that they never for a second calculate other costs of policing, not just the cost of the spending, but the cost of the killings that police engage in. Police commit about 8% of all homicides in the United States, legal or otherwise. They also never consider whether or not there are different investments that could pay even higher returns. This is never calculated either.
Well, 8% of homicides, legal or otherwise. The legal matters. The otherwise is the issue. The legal is not. So the 1,000 people that are killed by police, I mean, whether it's a justified, whether justified or not matters.
And lives lost, if we're just measuring the cost and lives lost, that calculation should be added into the cost of policing.
Well, fine, but you cannot conflate justified use of lethal force from unjustified lethal use of lethal force.
Unless we can provide evidence that says we could save those lives without killing anyone, which is, I feel like, what we can do.
So you started in that bite I played from your appearance on The Daily Show last year, talking about how police enforce these systems of oppression, racism in poor communities. Well, that apparently is going unnoticed by the overwhelming majority of the residents of those poor communities, because a Gallup survey last year had 80% of Black Americans want the same or more police presence where they live.
Yes, well, for 40 years, we've told those residents that they can have one and only one thing to produce safety in their communities, and that's more police. And so when we ask them, would you rather have more police or nothing, they say, guess what, we would like more police, even though those same surveys show deep dissatisfaction with policing. What we're trying to say is that we want to give people other choices to make than just policing. And more recent surveys after this summer's public conversations about alternatives to policing show actually a significant growth in public interest in non-police strategies.
And What is your assessment of, and at whatever pace you suggest, of what the impact would be on crime, particularly violent crime, reducing police forces while you're, I guess, energizing this replacement for said police?
Well, so in Denver, they just released 6 months of data about diverting 911 calls away from police and to mental health outreach teams. The results were incredibly positive. It reduced the need for policing. It's saving the city money. We have similar results from other cities. We have a lot of research about community-based anti-violence strategies that work better than policing. We just need to start implementing more of these things, evaluating the results, taking it one step at a time, and reducing the scope of policing. So it's not about giving police more work to do because there are fewer of them. It's about taking away whole areas of responsibility where we just shouldn't be using police in the first place.
But again, the specific area of responsibility, responding to 911 calls involving an alleged crime, an alleged act of violence, is that the purview of police, or is that the purview of community anti-policing initiatives, in your view?
Well, look, in Chicago, only about 5% of all 911 calls have anything remotely to do with violence. And in the vast majority of those cases, the police response is well after the violence has already occurred. So let's be realistic about this, right? Police are not catching armed robbers in the act. That is a once-in-a-career achievement for a patrol officer. 95% of what police do has nothing to do with that. So let's start scaling all that stuff back.
Well, yeah, but community response teams and mental health professionals aren't going to catch people in the act either. They're responsive and reactive in nature, generally speaking. Police presence in an area matters, number one. Number two, police expertise and training with respect to maintaining the peace, if you will, maintaining order, and then going about solving the crimes with detectives and so forth. I mean, I'm not clear whether or not you think that is the legitimate purview of police if they're going to exist, or you don't think so and they shouldn't exist at all.
Well, look, I certainly agree that if we just disappeared all police tomorrow, there would be, you know, really horrible negative consequences for that. But that's not what I'm proposing. What I'm talking about is incrementally using evidence-based strategies to dial back policing in as many ways as we can. And I think the evidence shows we could do that for a huge amount of what police do right now.
He is Alex Vitale. He's a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. He's also the author of The End of Policing. Professor Vitale, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you, Alex. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and we just spoke with Brooklyn College sociology professor Alex Vitale about ending policing.
Yeah.
That same roundtable discussion he was a part of on The Daily Show last year included, among others, Patrice Cullors, who he mentioned. Patrice Cullors, one of the Marxist co-founders of Black Lives Matter. Also author Michael Denzel Smith, who had this to say about police abolition and ending policing. He seems to take it quite literally.
What does that mean?
We say abolish the police because we mean abolish the police, right? There's no mincing of language there. There's nothing that we're trying to trick you on.
Thank you. I appreciate the candor. Professor Vitale suggesting that it's more a transition from policing, at least many of the responsibilities that are imposed upon police at present, to social workers, to proactive community response teams, and so forth.
Yeah, I don't think
people a chance to react.
Right, and I don't think the Professor Vitale has been the victim of a violent crime. Do you, Dan?
Well, I don't know. I hope not. But
well, if he was, I don't think he'd feel the way that he felt. I mean, I think our men and women in uniform deserve better. and they need to be protected.
Well, the question is, what happens to violent crime if you reduce or eliminate police? Not just violent crime, but specifically violent crime. And the answer you get from Professor Vitale is not much of one. And frankly, it's not just me saying it. It's also men and women on the left, like Matt Iglesias over at Vox, saying the same thing. If you read his book, sort of, it's very gooey in terms of imagining what would replace police in that role of peacekeeper. Take a couple of your calls. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro, text line Ed in LaGrange. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Really good interview with him, Dan. I don't think he was ready for the responses or didn't expect the kind of responses that you gave him. He's probably used to sitting around a table where no one challenges him on those crazy statements he makes. I also would have asked him if he was related to Dick Vitale, the guy who used to do sports casting with Al McGuire.
No, he's still there. He's doing Geico commercials now. Dick Vitale.
Vitale.
Some of the conclusions he had were as goofy as the stuff that Dick Vitale used to say when he was on the radio. I mean, his statistics or his conclusions are based upon phony statistics. 8% of the homicides are caused by police. In 2020, there were 430 white people killed by police, 220 black people, 150 Latin or Mexican people. I mean, but he didn't point that out, and you did kind of bring that out. When you tell him, how about the studies that show in impoverished neighborhoods people want more police? His response, well, sure. When they're offered more police or no police, what do you expect them to say? Well, I don't think that was a survey question. I'm sure there was more involved in it than that. So, again, he's coming from an area in academia that has no basis in reality. That's the way I look at him. So.
Thanks for the call, Ed. Appreciate it. You know, one of the questions, too, we ran out of time, but has anybody asked social workers if they want to do these calls?
Right. Raise your hand. Who wants to go to that domestic violence we got on 53rd Street?
Yeah.
Sure.
And would they want to respond to those calls if they were unable to be armed to protect themselves?
Well,
would they want to respond to those calls if they also had limited immunity, if they were forced to defend themselves and they were injured or they injured somebody they were responding to? You know, it's one thing to imagine it in the abstract. It's another thing to imagine it with the same limitations and the same rules and regulations and the same legal exposure that the left wants to impose on police.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't go there without a bulletproof vest on. But yeah, if something goes awry, he or she could end up in a civil lawsuit.
Regina in Homer Glen.
Good morning, guys. I was just listening to this guy, and it really caused me to want to call you. First of all, these self-important people just want to put their stank on an issue so they can write an article and add it to their resume. By his account, he can walk the streets of a major city and wave his magic wand and make it Shangri-La, all while wearing a T-shirt that says, I'm a professor of sociology, so the bad guys know they better behave. And I can guarantee you that he has never done a drive along with a beat cop in Chicago at night. And if he did, he would have to change his pants. And I can also guarantee he's never been a victim of a violent crime.
Yep.
I'm the female version of your cigar guy from Elmwood Park.
Are you police?
Retired.
Retired police. Okay. Thanks for the call, Regina. Yeah. Now for the slightly more male version of our guy, cigar guy from Elmhurst, Sean from Elmwood Park.
Hi, Sean.
Well, good morning. Listen, Prof, that was excellent. I give you a lot of credit. You know, I would have jumped down his throat, but you did phenomenal. The professor with his little bow tie. So listen here,
Thank
Mr.
So
Peabody.
Much.
What I love about it, not only was I thinking about Return of the Primitives. You remember that book where she predicted all of this stuff? But while you were going on, I have the updates on my phone. A woman in Grisham was beaten and molested in her apartment. She manages to run outside screaming, where they chased her and shot her. This all happened 20 minutes ago while that interview was going on. And all I kept thinking is, was she screaming for a social worker? I mean, is anybody got a social worker? It is perfect, and I'm going to make a fortune because I'm going to do the neighborhood Blackwater Prof. You could be the legal consultant or whatever cushy job you want. And we're going to make a fortune. This guy from Winnetka, whatever neighborhood he's from outside of Brooklyn, they have contempt for everyone. And they think they have the answers right up until someone's ears slapping them and they're wetting their trousers. Then you're not yelling for a social worker, egghead. I can't wait for the future. I'm going to make a fortune.
Well, thanks for the call, Sean. A Return of the Primitive, good Ayn Rand book, but let's expand your readership a little bit, Sean, and let's get outside of Ayn Rand. It's good. It's nothing wrong with Ayn Rand, and I'm a fan, but you know, let's you know, expand our perspective a little bit. Monica and Lyle.
Hi, guys. You know, I was going to say there's an actor by the name of Denzel Washington who who's spoken a lot about the subject, and I don't really give him short shrift, given some of his views, and he's kind of gutsy on some of the stuff that he says. But one thing he did say is, by the time you call the police, generally it's too late. That's like the last resort.
Thanks for the call, Monica. Yeah, we actually referenced Denzel when he was promoting his latest movie that was on that HBO, right? Yeah, I think so. He talked about doing a ride-along in preparation for Training Day, and the newfound respect he had for police after doing those ride-alongs, I think.
Yeah. Alex should get a ride-along. You've done a ride-along, and I've done a bunch, too. And it's you have no idea until you're out there.
It's true. Mike in Harwood Heights.
Good morning, guys. Great show. You know, a couple years ago, I heard a joke about social workers that explains their thinking, and it goes like this. Two social workers come across a guy laying on a sidewalk. He's been beaten to a pulp. They ask him what happened. He said, well, I was robbed by four thugs. They took my watch, my wallet, my money. And after I gave them everything, they still proceeded to beat me nearly to death. And the social worker responds, that's terrible. Can you describe them? What were they wearing? What did they look like? Which way did they go? They need help.
Right. All right, Mike, thanks for the call. Oh, boy. Bob in Edison Park.
Yeah, guys, one quick point. Do you know the testing sites for COVID on Pulaski Day were closed? It's hard to believe that a virus so deadly takes a holiday. But on the policing issue, what are they – how many social workers – okay, if we could get social workers to show up and all those other questions – how many are they going to need to employ? Do they have any idea of the number of, and then they do, the number of volumes of calls just on domestics? Let's just say you send these social workers to domestic calls, which tend to be the most volatile and violent. How many social workers would they need? How long would they get to spend with these people? So say you have a limited, you have a certain number, but how long are they going to spend consoling this family or this offender or the victim? Where is the cost analysis? This guy talks about costs with police if they get in a shooting or police corruption. What, how many social workers are you going to need? What are their benefits going to entail? These are questions that I'd like to see these people answer. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Jim on the South Side.
Hello.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing? I'm a retired Chicago police sergeant, and I've worked in busy districts. I was also working in Englewood for some time. And, you know, this guy has no clue the number of violent crimes that are going on in an 8-hour tour of duty. And the bottom line is this. I'd love to see the police say, look, this is not my call. Send in a social team. And that, let them handle it. Let them take care of everything. And you know what? It would absolve the city of Chicago from lawsuits, absolve officers from complaints, would absolve everything, and see what happens and see if, in fact, this guy's theories on a piece of paper in a classroom setting actually work in a real-life setting, such as in Inglewood or in any of the busy districts in Chicago.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Maybe a leading indication of what it would be like to have social workers replace police is how we've had social workers replace prosecutors.
Oh,
haven't
yeah.
we? Effectively, yep. All the Soros-backed prosecutors around the country, aren't they just social workers with a law degree? Lewis on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Hello.
What's a social worker with a gun?
What is a social worker with a gun, Lewis?
a policeman.
There you go. Thank you.
Hey, we got, I think that gentleman, I think he doesn't realize that what he's doing is called a pleaseman. And I think he need to be saying, we are not so worthy, you know. He's doing a pleaseman, you know. I don't think he recognized what he's doing.
Thanks for the call, Lewis. Appreciate it. Byron in Lombard.
Yeah, hey, one thing that I'm not hearing is, what about the preventative measures for, I'm just going to go general here, society as a whole? Where are the preventative measures of going, we have tremendous lack of economic development in a lot of these areas. Why don't we start working on that? The police are secondary. They only show up when crime occurs. If people have jobs and they have quality communities, because there's jobs there and they have an investment in it, then there is no need for police. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, thanks for the call. I mean, we didn't get into it, but this whole tapestry that the professor talked about, he's right. I mean, these things are inextricably linked, but he's looking at the wrong link. You know, police are reactive by nature. They're responsive, but they're also responsive to how you operate these other links in the chain. So, for example, the quality of your K-12 school system, the intactness of families in your particular neighborhood or community that are leading indicators of what kind of neighborhood or community you're going to have, what it will be like in terms of public safety, because people are responsible and educated and peaceful, pluralist and nonviolent. They don't tolerate predators. You get policing. You have economic development. You have private property rights, so you have skin in the game. You have a stake in society. So, you know, police are at the end of that, not the beginning of it. And so I think he's got the order a bit reversed. John in Lake Geneva.
Yeah, this new generation, the young generation of police officers, it's a good thing they grew up watching Barney the Purple Dinosaur, so they know how to say please and thank you, arresting murderers and drug dealers.
Thanks for the call, John. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.